Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And before we meet Mei Fong, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. We're about to now have a conversation with Mei Fong, who joins us here in studio. Her book is One Child, the story of China's most radical experiment. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. I've been covering Asia for well over 10 years. She was China correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Has won awards from the Amnesty International, New York Society of Professional Journalists, Society of Publishers in Asia, and more, and is still writing and working. We'll talk a bit about that as well. And welcome to the studio. Good to have you with us, Mei.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But as the conversation moves you, give us a holler, 410-319-8888, and we'll tell you this again later. But to follow up, you can meet her tonight at 7 p.m. At the University of Baltimore's Business Center Auditorium as part of the Pratt Library UB Live series. Always a great series of conversations and public interaction with the people they bring in, like Mei Fong. So, again, welcome, Mei. Good to have you here. So this is really, you know, many people have read over the course of the last 30 years about this one child policy of China. But you know, and there's been a lot of critique of it, and saying, "Oh, this is the authoritarian governments run amok and telling families how to live." But the complexity of it is really what you're trying to have us wrestle with here,
mm-hmm.
I think, and that's because you can take it and look at this very simplistically if you wanted to.
Certainly, you know, it's a government entering into the bedroom and telling you how many children you should or should not have. That's the very straightforward outside view. But at the same time, you also balance that against, you know, the numbers of people in China, right? If you've ever visited China, you ever tried to take a subway in a major city at rush hour or visit the Great Wall there's just a lot of people. The crush of humanity is enormous. So balance between these two views, intrusion and making sure that people have enough resources is the big question. Oh, yeah.
And it is. And I love the way you begin this. I mean, you have this great quote in here by Christopher Hitchens, how you start the book. Two sorts of errors are absolutely commonplace. The first of these is the idiotic belief that seismic events are somehow timed to express the will of God. People will seriously attempt to guess what sin or which profanity led to the verdict of the tectonic plates. So you write this as a chapter opens as you're taking this train and to where the earthquakes took place and children lost their lives, and all this red clay around you just kind of stuns you. So tell us a connection for that. Why you opened that way?
So I opened a book talking about the Sichuan earthquake in 2008. That was China's biggest natural disaster in three decades. Over 70,000 people were killed in an 8.0 Richter-scale earthquake. But what did that have to do with the one-child policy, you might ask? Well, it turns out, first of all, there were a lot of children killed in the earthquake because the schools were badly built, and they all crumbled on them. They called them tofu schools. And initially when I covered it as a journalist, I was just covering it as a natural disaster. But I discovered very early on that not only were a lot of children killed, a lot of these were only children because, as it turned out, the area near the epicenter of the earthquake was a test pilot project for the one-child policy.
This particular place that you
Yes.
Right.
So a lot of parents lost not only their children, they lost their only child. So the repercussions of that were strange. Like, for example, within a matter of weeks, people were rushing to the hospital to get a reverse sterilization process to try and get a second child, because part of the one-child policy is after you've had your quarter of kids, you're supposed to get sterilized. That's a requirement. You don't get to choose.
You know, one of the things I want to get into the heart of the book, but one of the things that let me just the broad overview for a minute. I thought about how reading this book and the forced sterilizations, forced abortions, the pain that is reverberated in terms of taking care of society as people get older and all the rest, the complications you write about, that there's something about the way societies around the globe carry out their social policies are often on the backs of women.
Oh, yes.
Right? And that have to do with a woman's right to have a baby or not to have a baby, mm-hmm. the right to choose, or woman's, or whether we're talking about genital
mutilation.
Right. And there's so many pieces of our control around women and women's emotions, women's bodies, women's minds. And this is just – it's a piece of that. It's like a – this universal thing. My sister and I talk a lot about how the notion of misogyny and what happens to women is as ancient as humankind almost.
Well, that's right, Mark. I mean, you know, it's happening also in this society in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we'll have
I wasn't
huge discussions. but if you look at China per se, we're looking at something like 50 million missing women, that were never born or aborted, or children, girl fetuses that were aborted, or girl children that were given away or infanticide as a result, in part because of a longstanding preference for sons in China, which was accentuated by a very strict population planning policy that we call the one-child policy. So it's a huge issue, you know. It's you know, that's a lot of women. That's twice the population of Canada almost.
Right, and so that was just that's what I reflected on as I thought about you coming in today and what you wrote about, just about this. It's a universal story seen through and writ large through this China's one-child policy, and that I just wanted to throw that out there before we started. But let me talk about some things that were in here that I think that the way this began. With certain people who both people who kind of helped create this policy and how they looked at it. If I pronounce names incorrectly, you'll correct me. Song Jian.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, Liang Zhongtang.
Yeah, Liang Zhongtang. Yeah.
So at the very beginning, the way China looked at this policy, talk a bit about why it even began before we get into those two people.
Okay, sure. So China has always been very populous as a nation. And certainly during the period, during Mao's time, Mao encouraged people
Mao
Zedong.
Right.
Yeah, Mao encouraged people to have children. You know, he thought he had the whole Soviet Stalin plan economy saying greater productivity equals more people. So at the time when he died, and the time when China was in the 70s, they had, you know, a big population. They were very concerned that, you know, that China would, there would never be enough resources for everyone. And China wasn't the only place that was worried about that. This was the era of the zero population growth movement, and Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb,
A quote by him in the book.
Yeah, and was an unexpected bestseller. I mean, who knew, you know, a Stanford economics book would be, you know, a bestseller. You know? So the people were very concerned at that time, not only China. So they wanted to put in place something. The thing was, China actually already had a population planning policy in place, been going on for about 10 years before that. And the whole thing was, it was called later, longer, and fewer. The whole idea was to encourage people to get married later, have fewer children, longest period between kids. And it was actually pretty successful. Average family size went from something like 6 kids to 3. So, but then because the new leadership decided that, you know, we need to prosper, we need to, Deng Xiaoping basically set an economic goal. He wanted to quadruple the GDP per capita by the year 2000. And so, you know, working back, the scientists calculated they weren't going to reach those kind of goals or targets without, you know, seriously accelerating the population, you know, reductions. So they said, no, we need to move to a one-child policy. And then they had rocket scientists.
That's the part that's so fascinating. So here you're at this point where the people that designed this policy were not physicians. They were not women. They were not people who were involved in any of this stuff, but literally people who were studying mathematics and physics and
missiles. Rocket trajectories.
Which has its own kind of poetic euphemisms there, but I mean... So, what was that?
Well, this was coming off the Cultural Revolution. So basically, if you were an academic or a scientist or any kind of a learned person in China, you probably suffered immensely during the Cultural Revolution. You had no social capital, no political capital. You didn't even have computers probably to calculate anything. The only branch of learning that was left untouched were the military scientists. So they were the ones with not only the equipment and the boldness of thinking to work out these policies at the behest rest of the leadership. And so when they said, we calculate this, this, their words were kind of taken as gospel. And nobody else was able to make some form of dissent. Don't forget, you'd probably punished if you said something. And then so the demographers, the economists, the sociologists, all the people who might be able to sort of interject some questions into the whole process were basically A, afraid to speak, or B, ignored. You mentioned one guy, Liang Zhongtang.
Yeah, right.
And he was an obscure economist, and he was one of the few people, in fact, probably the only one, who came out vocally against the one-child policy at its inception. And he was, I call him China's Cassandra, because a lot of the things he predicted has come to pass, but nobody listened. You know, he said, you know, this is a crazy idea because we're going to have a nation that's a lot of old people and not enough young people to take care of them. We're going to have a big gender imbalance. You know, these are all, you know, huge issues.
He was really prescient. We'll get to all that in a little bit, but he was really prescient about all these things.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's not rocket science to figure out some of these things, you know, human behavior. If this country likes boys and they say everybody has only one son, what do you think everybody's going to have?
But their motivation was because they were trying to control the amount of people, population growth in China.
Well, GDP, you know, you work it up per capita, right? It's increased productivity over per number of miles. So they weren't too sure about increasing productivity, but they felt that they could definitely control the per number of miles. So that was, you know, simple.
It seems to me in some ways like the we were talking about this before we went on the air, that China has become in many ways the ultimate capitalist nation. An authoritarian capitalist nation at that as well.
Mm-hmm. Capitalism with socialist characteristics. That's what
they
call it.
I think they've lost most of the socialist characteristics. And the bottom has fallen out. I mean, China used to have programs where the medical people were actually taken care of in terms of health and
hallmarks of communist planned economy was you get free schooling or free health care and all those things.
And that's gone.
Yeah, no, that's nothing. That's none of that. Yeah.
So how does this fit into that?
Well, I think one of the big problems going ahead they're going to have is the whole issue of elder care, right? By 2050, one in four Chinese will be a retiree. So, and the problem with that is you have a much smaller base of people to support it. Don't forget, you got one child per family for about a third of the nation. You know, who's going to take care of all those people? So either China has to roll out a huge social safety net, or they'll have to get all these people to really step up to the plate and support the families, which is what they've tried to do with a variety of laws that make it so that you have to support elderly parents, and also that you have to visit them often. I don't know. It's not enforceable, but they actually made it a law.
I'm going to come back to that point. I think it's a very important piece, and I want to get into that in greater depth. I think that there are some pieces here that were really very deeply troubling just in terms of human scale of what happens. And the Feng Jianmei.
Yeah, Feng Jianmei, yeah.
Right? The woman who, a factory worker, became pregnant and was with her second child and was forced to have an abortion, I think.
At 7 months.
7 months, right?
Yep.
And then these pictures went viral. So talk about, in terms of the extent of where that policy went. Mm-hmm. And what happens to people like Feng
Jianmei? Well, here's the thing, right? I think for a long time, and you know, certainly the UN believed it for a long time, that the people believed that the policy, at least people chose to believe that the policy was not coercive, people outside in the Western world. I mean, at one point, the UN actually gave gold medals for population control.
To China.
One to China and one to India, which did a forced sterilization program. So, they for a long time said they believed that no coercion was involved, which is actually nonsense, because you could never do something like this without some amount of force, you know, something so tight and rigid. You know, you couldn't even get people in America to not drink alcohol without some without all sorts of repercussions. Can you imagine this one? So so for a long time, in order to make this work, you needed a variety of sticks, and one of those sticks, if you call it that, was forced abortion, the threat of a forced abortion. Basically, even though it was illegal to do a late-term abortion by force, to all intents and purposes, every family planning official I spoke to pretty much said that it was, you, as long as you haven't delivered the baby, it's kind of fair game that they can take you away for a forced abortion. And if you didn't want to go for one, they could. They had all sorts of measures. They could make you lose your job. They could damage your property, wreck your house, or in some cases, maybe imprison some loved member of your household, detain them for a bit, maybe your mother or your father, put them in a cell and say, you know what, you don't show up for this abortion by this date, your mom's in jail for an indefinite period of time. So a lot of these things were, the high tide of this, we believed for a long time, was in the 90s. And then by the time I moved to China in the mid-2000s, China was in a huge upswing, you know, economically. And the belief was that a lot of this was no longer happening, not that common, not that important, that certainly people were making enough money and having enough choices to not want the children or pay for the extra children. But then in 2012, there was this case, Feng Jianmei. She was a factory worker. She was pregnant with her second child. She was asked to pay a fine of something like $6,000 at the time that neither she nor her husband could afford. And so she kept trying to sort of, you know, evade the population police. You know, that's what a lot of people did, you know, sort of wait until you deliver the baby. So even if you had to pay the fine after that, at least you had the baby, because before then, all bets were off. So she did this. She managed this evasion process until she was in her 7 months. And then they caught her and they took her away to the hospital with a pillowcase over her head and injected her with anti-abortant solutions that caused her to abort the baby. So all this would probably, you know, we wouldn't know about except, you know, social media was happening in China at the time. She was in a bed and a relative came over and snapped a picture of her on the bed with this fetus, which at 7 months, it's very well formed. It really loves, it looks like a baby, yeah. You know, eyes, nose, mouth. And so, you know, that shocked China. You know, a lot of people in the cities had just thought all this stuff was behind them. They had no idea it was still going on. And so, you know, in the same, like, we see a photo of that little kid in a, you know, and you know, who died in a Serbian refugee, right? One picture can make, you know, a thousand things, you know, can make it so clear what's going on.
To me, it's amazing what the technology has done to kind of change the way we think and look at things, just what it brings to the public. And also how disconnected people are. I mean, this, you know, we think about people, we were talking just the last hour a little bit about the disconnection between people who do not live in the city or people who do not live in the conditions of poverty that many black people do in Baltimore City and around this country, and people who live in the suburbs not even understanding what's going on. But it's the same thing in China, when you just, that nobody really realizing, even in China itself, that this one-child policy was still going on and that people were being sterilized, having forced sterilizations and forced abortions throughout China. She's not an isolated example.
No, she wasn't. You know, I mean, as late as 2010, Amnesty reported they had a mass sterilization exercise in Guangzhou, which is in southern China, of 10,000 people. 10,000 people. Right. Do you think some of them were pretty clearly, you know, unwilling to be sterilized? What do you think? What are the odds?
it was kind of very revealing. I mean, I had no idea the depth of it. I think many people did not unless they followed it closely. But you also talk about these cultural phenomena that took place as a result of that. Again, if my Chinese pronunciation is bad, you'll correct me. But the whole group of people who lost their children in the earthquakes, having only one child, forming this world of millions of people called the Shidu.
Yeah, Shidu.
Shidu?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a name for parents who've lost their only child. And that term didn't really exist until after the earthquake when so many people did lose their only child. And, you know, you might ask yourself, so, you know, people all around the world, not just China, lose their child. In some cases, they lose their only child. So I know it's a huge tragedy, but, you know, how is that more different or, you know, in China. So the issue with China is it's still a very family-centric society for all that maybe you only have one, and it's very traditional. So the concept of family, even though you only have one child in many cases now, is still husband, wife, and child. And you are not considered an adult until you're married. You're not considered to have fulfilled your duties to the family until you have a child. So when you don't have a child anymore, you lose social standing. You lose, especially in the villages, you have nothing. And also you lose financial stability because, you know, the social safety net we talked about, not really set up very well. So if you don't have a child to support you, you got nothing at the end of the day. One of the people I talk to and I write about in a book is a guy who lost his teenage daughter in an earthquake. 3 weeks later, he's in hospital trying to have a reverse vasectomy. And he and his wife, they were telling me that, you know, in their village, which is very poor, they said all their neighbors started avoiding them because he said, you know, they think that we're just going to be this, you know, useless hanger-ons. We have no children to support us or take care of us anymore. And we just feel like we cannot live, you know.
One thing that's hit me again about that, maybe start thinking about, was that, I mean, family is defined and is important kind of in every culture, but defined very differently. And the sense of, I wrote down, of death and family continuance in Chinese family culture is a really interesting phenomenon and how it's been affected by this policy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, here's the thing, right? So in China, we don't have it's not really a set of a religious society the way you think about it in other places, like, you know, Christianity or Catholic societies, for example. What for the majority of most Chinese is a collection of beliefs that are rooted in Taoism and Confucianism. We believe that after death, we need our descendants to take care of us to some extent. That's why we burn paper money, you know, to feed our ancestors, to supply them with things. So if you don't have any descendants, then you as a hungry ghost in the next afterlife will have nothing. You know, I mean, when my father died, and we still do every year, we burn paper money for him. I mean, it's actually literally printed. It says Bank of Hell. and then you also buy all sorts of little things like, you know, you burn a black paper Amex card or you know, little houses, little Ferraris, little iPhones. I mean, it's you know, China is a very mercantile society. Other communities, other religious beliefs, you know, you can't take it with you. China, you believe you can. And you need descendants to make sure you get some of that in the next life. So you don't have any, you're a hungry ghost.
Interesting phenomenon. I can just see it. I was thinking about a Christmas Carol. You can do it in a Chinese version of Christmas Carol. The ghost passed, but also, so what this policy in terms of you're looking at how it disrupted culture, how it disrupted the culture of the people itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, China for a long time has been a society about families, about clans, right? And it's very minutely created this whole network. For example, it's down to your language. You know, I have aunts and uncles. There's no such word as generic word as an uncle or aunt. There's a distinctive, specific word to describe your relationship. Is this your uncle on your father's side or your mother's side? Different names. Is it an older uncle than your father or mother or a younger one? Different name also. So all this lexicon is gone now, going away, because you only have one child, right? There's no uncles or anything. And this is the second generation of one children. So all these
That's
terms.
That's right. This is second generation.
Yeah, all these right, terms right. are like Latin. They're going out of the way. They're completely useless now. They don't describe. They describe a thing that doesn't exist anymore.
So what do you think this means, though? I mean, for the future, in terms of when parts of a culture are destroyed like that. I mean, you know, whether you believe in all the things that you just eloquently described, I mean, when those things are gone, when you don't have those familiar relationships, when they've been torn asunder, what does that mean for?
Well, on a very practical level, one of the big problems is, you know, when it comes to elder care. You know, in the past, you know, the whole Chinese society was very rooted around the concept of shou, you know, filial piety. You have to take care of your parents. You owe it to them. You know, I mean, we still read a collection of short stories. It's like Grimm's fairy tales to children, where they describe, you know, all these very filial kids who take care of their parents. There's a little kid who lets himself be bitten by mosquitoes so that that his parents don't get bitten by mosquitoes. There's a woman who breastfeeds her toothless mother-in-law because, you know, to give her nourishment, you know. These are the kind of, you know, things that work still. But then, you know, come the Cultural Revolution, all these filial piety concepts were smashed. You were encouraged to, you know, speak out against your parents, you know, speak out against your elders. So now you got a lot of elders, and then the government has to resurrect these whole principle again, because there's just not enough, you know, Social Security or Medicare, Medicaid to take to replace that. You still need children to take care of their parents. So the question or the challenge is, can you put back what you pulled apart?
Difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take a brief break and come back to talk a bit more here with Mei Fang about her book, One Child, The Story of China's Most Radical Experiment, 410-319-8888. Be back in a minute. Stay with us. Back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with Mei Fang talking about her book, One Child, The Story of China's Most Radical Experiment. And she will be speaking tonight at the University of Baltimore's auditorium at 7 p.m. at the Business Center Auditorium, part of the Pratt Library and UB Live's University of Baltimore Live series. Tonight at 7 p.m., where you can meet her in person. Join us now at 410-319-8888 as we explore her book. For a little bit longer here, One Child, The Story of China's Most Radical Experiment. One of the things that there have been so many twists in this, from political twists to what the Chinese government said this was going to do. Let me start there, and then we'll go into these other two pieces here I really want to talk about.
Sure.
Which is that China, as you wrote, the Chinese government said there will stop 400 more million people being born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what the Chinese government said, but that's not necessarily true. For a long time, a lot of people, I think outside of China particularly, were kind of inclined to give the one-child policy a little bit of a pass. You know, there are still people who will say it was a good idea because we have too many people on the planet. And certainly the Beijing for a long time promoted this idea because they said we save by our calculations, we prevented 400 million births. Now, what is 400 million births? That means about two Americas, you know. So that's big. That's huge. But in actual fact, the numbers were a little bit of over-optimistic, over-calculation there. And I know you're asking me, hey, Asian people, surely they can count. But in this case... the calculations were based on birth trajectories of people in the 60s and 70s, you know. So there's the idea that, okay, if people are sort of giving birth like in this kind of a rate of proportion, we follow that out, that's going to be the way it's going to be in 2030. So if this was how much it would be, then this is how much we save. But in actual fact, and I talked to some demographers who've done a great deal of work on that, they calculated that it was closer to more like 100 to 200 million, if at that, you know, that was saved. So, okay, that's still a lot of people, you know, that's still one America. So that's still a lot. But, you know, your equal argument balance against that is, could you have done this without going to the one-child policy extreme? You know, here's the thing. You know, every other nation around China at that time, we're talking South Korea, we're talking Thailand, we're talking Taiwan, Malaysia, Singapore, also have their birth rate and, you know, reduce their birth rate significantly and also turbocharge their economy without having to go to a one-child policy extreme. You know, they did all the things that you do when you want to reduce your population. You send women to college. You give them better opportunities. You give them more access to contraception. You move to urbanization, you know, promote urbanization cities. You know, people don't need so many children in the cities. All these bring down the birth rate without any of these crazy side effects.
But it's indicative in many ways of the kind of what governments can do with their power when they think their policies are what the world needs, mm-hmm. or the people need.
Mm-hmm.
Without consulting people.
Well, you know, and in China's case, there's no room for dissent. You know, you can't go to the ballot box and say, I'm sorry, I object to this thing, and this is what I don't want. I'm going to vote this guy out of office. There's no such mechanism. You know, in India's case, when they had forced sterilization, that's exactly what people did. They voted Indira Gandhi out of office, you know, because of that.
That was a part of her downfall.
Yes. You know, and she did come back eventually at some point, but she also ended the forced sterilization program, you know, because it was clearly a big no-no in India. Now, India, of course, as we agree, has lots of problems now with overpopulation and other things too, but that's a different kettle of fish.
We'll have, as you pointed out, we'll have more people than China within 25 years. Is that right?
Sorry, yeah.
India will have more people than China?
Very soon, at some point, India is going to be the most populous nation. Right. That's a crown that China is very kind of glad to hand over.
Yeah. So let's talk about the cultural phenomenons here, the time we have left. What we, as we went to break, and it is, it's fascinating to me, before we get into the whole question of women and acute gender imbalance, as you write about. And again, it's Guanggong,
yeah.
Broken branches,
yeah.
Or
that's what you call bachelor men. What do you call broken branches? Bachelor men who have no chance of finding brides,
right?
And
right.
Because of the female shortage in China, there's something like 30 million of these guys who can't find these women. You know, unless China imports a population the size of Canada, all of women to meet their needs, which isn't likely to happen.
But talk about that. That comes to this whole thing about. There are 30 million more men than women,
mm-hmm.
But part of that's because people wanted male babies and were boarding babies that they knew because the General Electric had these portable scans that would go into, as you write about, go into villages and in neighborhoods and can tell people what or not later on in this mm-hmm. process whether they're going to have a male or a boy or a girl.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, right? Policy doesn't always account for technology, right? So when the policy was implemented in 1980, the whole ability for people to scan for the sex of their gender wasn't quite prevalent then. But in the 1990s, that's what happened. Companies like General Electric started making these scanners that were portable enough and small enough so that you could find them even in, you know, small village, small city, townships, and you could get a scan for relatively cheaply. And even though the government at some point figured it out and made it a law illegal for doctors to tell parents whether it was a boy or girl, you know, there were ways to get around it. You know, if you had a girl, maybe the doctor would hand you a pink suite. If you had a boy, you know, blue suite, you know, cough if it's a girl, and smile if it's a boy. You know, all these cues, you know, all in exchange for a little bit of money under the counter, you know, for families that valued sons, it was worth it to know. Yeah.
So now you had, so this created, though, some interesting phenomenon. One was what we just talked about, these men who, what was the other word you used? They're called horny men of China now?
Well, I mean, you got 30 million young men, you know, and I think I quote Paul Ehrlich, the singer who wrote The Population Bomb, and he says,
from,
you know,
right.
He says there's going to be a gigantic mass of horny young men in China, you know, which is probably not an overstatement. There's certainly quite a lot of them will, you know, be very lonely. Yeah.
So, but what it meant was, this feeds directly into also the adoption industry.
Yes. And this is one of the most unexpected side effects and probably one of the most global effects, you know, that has brought the one-child policy straight into American households. When the one-child policy was implemented, you know, a lot of people were, you know, chose to have sons, right? They didn't want to use up their quota for a girl. So girls were either abandoned or given away or hidden away, and many of them ended up in orphanages, and the orphanages were overflowing. So China decided we are going to open our doors to global adoption. And this was like a boon, you know. Never before had the global adoption world ever had such a huge supply of young adoptable infants that were in a service that was supervised by the government. So a lot of people thought, okay, this is good. We are going to get a child that we desperately want. It's an unwanted, genuinely unwanted child. It's not baby trafficking because the Chinese government is overseeing. This is a clean process. We are doing a good thing, a mitzvah. And so over 120,000 children were adopted overseas as a result of the one-child policy from China. And out of that, about maybe 70,000 to 80,000 are here in America. And most of them are girls.
I mean, yeah, I've of all the people I know who have adopted children overseas and adopted Chinese children overseas, I don't know anybody who's adopted a boy.
There are some now. Most of them tend to be special needs, yeah, but most of them are girls, yeah.
Right. So this interesting twist here. So you have, in some ways, and there was some proof from people talking about the people selling their female children for money to be adopted.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, at some point, while the demand was strong, supply dried up. Because here's the thing, right? You have the scanning process coming in, so people stop carrying children, stop having girl children. They just abort. So then very soon, somewhere in the mid-2000s, the supply of adoptable infants dried up. But at the same time, the demand was still huge. And all these institutions had been set up for this market, all these orphanages and all. So what happened? Trafficking happened.
And that's a consequence of this.
Yes.
And the other upside-down piece of this was, so while that was going on, it also opened the door for many more young Chinese women to succeed in cities.
Yeah. I mean, if you were a girl child born after 1980 in a major Chinese city, chances are you were probably had it better than any other female at any other time in recent Chinese history. That's for sure. You would probably have a better chance of getting educated and fed because you had no siblings to compete with. And we see that also indirectly in America now. We have a huge implosion of students from mainland China who are making the biggest sector of our international students now, who are paying full freight at all these major universities. They are a major source of revenue, and most of them would not be here if they were not beneficiaries of the one-child system.
So that's it, to me, there's all these kind of twists and turns. So where does it – and we talked a bit about before we conclude, I mean, the numbers were there 25 years ago in terms of numbers of people working to take care of retirees, but there's a dramatic shift here.
Yeah, there are about like what – 5 working adults to support 1 retiree in China now. That's a great ratio, economically speaking. That's the kind of ratio that any country dreams of. In a matter of 20-something years, that is going to jump to 1.5 adults to support 1 retiree. That's a huge jump. That's kind of like where Japan is, and Japan's economy has been stagnant for the last 10 years,
So as someone who studies finances and studies business in the world and cover China, what does that mean for the future of China? We're watching now, everybody's very nervous in America about, not everybody, but there's nervousness about the power of the Chinese capitalist market and what it's going to do to the planet. Where does that take us all?
Well, we're very used to thinking of China as a major consumption market, right? World's largest consumers for cell phones and cars and so on. We see them as that. But, in a matter of 20-something years, that is going to be a major aging society. And guess what? Old people just don't need to buy the latest cell phones. They might be the world's largest adult diaper market, no question. But, all the things that we're used to thinking of in China, as a dynamic, growing society, it's going to change. And we are going to have to change our way of thinking about that. The world's second largest economy.
That's very funny. It's a fascinating book. I mean, I actually you learn a lot from this piece. And what's your next piece of work?
Oh, I don't know. I'm thinking about it, but I'm really not in a position to discuss anything at this point in time.
But you're still covering China for Wall Street?
No, I'm kind of like I'm a fellow at New America now, so I look at I look at China a lot in lots of different ways, and I'm very interested in what's going on, obviously, because this is just the first step of the one child policy. Now they're phasing it out, so we're going to see a lot of these things coming out. Come 10, 20 years down the line, there's going to be another book written about it. That's going to be very different, I think.
What the end of the policy has meant.
Yeah, what the end of the policy has been and some of these unexpected side effects. I read all these funny things coming up all the time now. One of the things I didn't write about in a book, which I saw is probably an effect, is the rise of child brides again in certain parts of China. People encouraging kids 13 or 14 to get married again.
Really?
Because they're worried about the falling birth rate. So they want the kids to get married and produce the children before they go off to the factories to work and leave the grandparents with something.
Well, one of the things that, before we end, one of the things that struck me about all the things you wrote is that it's almost in some ways a warning not just about China but about the rest of the world, is what certain policies can do to create this huge human dislocation. to change the nature of the social relationships between men and women around families. I mean, this is – I mean, it really is kind of a warning bell about where we go.
I know. When we think about, you know, China and the one-child policy, it's almost in a region of sci-fi, right? You're thinking Orwell or Aldous Huxley.
Exactly.
It's almost like a real-life illustration of these things. And one of the things I finish off in a book is, you know, because I talk about my children and I talk about my quest to have children too and all these business
right.
I have in,
right.
in China going through IVF and all that. And, you know, my children are 5 years old now, you know, and I tell them stories at night. You know, I tell them, you know, fairy stories at night, you know, stories
from Chinese. Yes.
Some Chinese fairy stories, you know, and all this, you know, this kind of stepmothers are evil and young girls are always persecuted. You know, there's a certain theme and thematic. And, you know, how will I explain the one-child policy to them in front of a form of a fairy tale? You know, once upon a time, there was a country so poor that an emperor decreed that everybody should only have one child. And then so a great sadness happened over the land. And, you know, people gave away their children or sought the help of magicians to make their one child the best possible. And over time, it became a country of the old. Yeah. That's about as far as I got. You know, I don't know the ending of that story.
I like that, though. That was Mei Fang, thanks so much for being here. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, the book is One Child, the story of China's most radical experiment. Mei Fang will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the University of Baltimore's Business Center Auditorium as part of the Pratt Library and University of Baltimore Live series. So go and have an interaction with her there and meet her there and get a copy of the book, which is well worth the read and makes you think about a great deal. So Mei Fang, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break and come back. It's time for the City Paper. Don't go away.